The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting cam, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
I don't even know how to begin things today. I could say, welcome to Gilead. So I sat here through that interminable roll call in the Senate when they took the vote. And it wasn't actually a vote on the Women's Health Protection Act. No, it was a cloture vote. This was essentially the vote to open debate on whether or not to codify Roe v. Wade into law, to take that Supreme Court decision that we have lived with for 49 years and say, yes, this is the law of the land, to do what these then nominees to the Supreme Court lied through their teeth about. And by the ones I'm talking about, I mean Neil Gorsuch, I mean Brett Kavanaugh, Beer, and Amy Coney Barrett. They all lied. That doesn't even get into the others who lied, like Alito and Clarence Thomas, because, you know, it's just sort of, I guess, accepted now. So here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that this is happening. This, you know what? For those who don't know, I'm saying Gilead like everybody knows. Gilead is the name that of the new nation formed in Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale after the religious nuts took over. And it was no longer the United States. It was Gilead. So I found online, hold on, I found this sort of, I guess, like a Cliff Notes explainer of what is, you know, what the Handmaid's Tale is all about. And I'm going to share this with you because I'm thinking we may need to have a book club. You know, I think there were already four seasons, or were there already five seasons on Hulu of The Handmaid's Tale. And again, for those who don't know, when it started, it was, you know, right after the former guy took office, and I emotionally could not handle it. But I went back some months later when I was feeling a little stronger, and I did watch it, and it's terrifying. But here's what I'm thinking. Yes, you can watch the show, the movie, and you should. It's now a series, and there's another season in production now. I read a report that they were out filming, and Elizabeth Moss, who's the lead, who plays June, or Offred, sorry, is how they referred to her at the beginning. She, four seasons, so they're in production on the fifth now, where they were on a shoot for the fifth season when the word came down of, you know, of what the Supreme Court draft decision said. And I guess her response was something like, holy shit, all right, well, we got some work to do here. Let's get back to it. So, but the thing is, in the fifth season, I guess they went beyond the book. All right. So let me play this short. It's a very short video. That is, again, this for those who are uninitiated, who don't know the story of The Handmaid's Tale. I'm going to play this for you. And I guess I should spell it out. So they held this cloture vote in the Senate. The final vote was 49-51. Every Republican senator voted against cloture, against even opening debate on the idea of codifying Roe v. Wade. So you're wondering, well, who was the 51st? Who do you think? Joe Manchin. Oh, my God. All right. So those who are unfamiliar with the story, here is the two-minute explainer by someone that I found on YouTube.
Chernobyl, The Handmaid's Tale.
It would help if I backed it up from the beginning. Here we go.
Right. In Margaret Atwood's near-future novel, The Handmaid's Tale, a Christian fundamentalist regime called the Republic of Gilead has staged a military coup and established a theocratic government in the United States. The regime theoretically restricts everyone, but in practice, a few men have structured Gilead so they have all the power, especially over women. The Handmaid's Tale was published in 1985, when many conservative groups attacked the gains made by the second wave feminist movement. This movement had been advocating greater social and legal equality for women since the early 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
The Handmaid's Tale imagines a future in which the conservative counter-movement gains the upper hand and not only demolishes the progress women had made toward equality, but makes women completely subservient to men.
Nice!
Gilead divides women in the regime into distinct social classes based upon their function as status symbols for men. Even their clothing is color-coded.
Yep.
Women are no longer allowed to read or move about freely in public. And fertile women are subject to state-engineered rape in order to give birth to children for the regime. The details of Gilead, which we've only skimmed the surface of, slowly come into focus through the eyes of its characters, mainly the novel's protagonist, Offred, a handmaid in the household of a commander. Before the coup that established Gilead, Offred had a husband, a child, a job, and a normal middle-class American life. But when the fundamentalist regime comes into power, Offred is denied her identity, separated from her family, and reduced to being, in Offred's words, a two-legged womb for increasing Gilead's waning population.
Mm-hmm.
She likens language to the formulation of identity. Her words also acknowledge the possibility of resistance. And it's resistance, the actions of people who dare to break the political, intellectual, and sexual rules that drives the plot of The Handmaid's Tale. Ultimately, the novel's exploration of the consequences of complacency and how power can be wielded unfairly makes Atwood's chilling vision of a dystopian regime ever relevant.
Yeah, and so that is this quick explainer of The Handmaid's Tale. And thanks to you guys in the chat room. It was great. So somebody, I think it was David, explained that the book is the first season of the TV show, which is now in production in its fifth. Margaret Atwood did release a sequel, The Testament, I think it was called, just a couple of years ago that I haven't read. And I don't know if it's aligned with the series or not. But here's what I'm thinking. You know, somebody else, first of all, I got to say, Jamie Paterna in the chat room said, oh, like the Playboy Mansion. No, not. Unless you are one of the commanders who would go off and do things like that. But yeah. And someone else said, why do we have to read it if we're living it? Well, that's the thing. In the book, I believe, of Fred, her real name is June, tries to think back as to what the signs were before it became Gilead, what the signs were that that's where they were headed. And it was like a drip, drip, drip. Well, we're in that drip now. We are living it. And that's the frightening thing. So I'm thinking we should do a banned book club thing and read The Handmaid's Tale. Now, again, we can cheat and watch the TV show, but I think we should read the original book. I mean, we can do it together as a group. We can set up a date by which the day we should all have the book, right? And then, maybe even do some special shows where we can read some out loud. We'll have our discussion group. The thing is, this is our reality now, and I really think that we need to be prepared for whatever that means. And, you know, this is frightening. This is so frightening that I find myself speechless, which, you know, doesn't happen very often. But so what do you guys think about that? Do the book club and read The Handmaid's Tale, or do we just sit here and bitch and moan that, you know, we're so screwed and we may as well just call it Gilead? I'm not sure. So that's something to think about. But that's where we are. We couldn't even get debate. They voted to not open debate. That's what the cloture vote was. It wasn't a vote on the Women's Health Protection Act. They didn't even get that far. And that should not only piss you off, it should scare the crap out of you, because this is not a democracy. So meanwhile, we're fighting the whole, you know, religious, the Christian Taliban Sharia law takeover, right? They want to tell us what we can and can't do with our bodies. Meanwhile, there's this war going on that, you know, we're not really involved in it, because if we were, then that might prompt Putin to use nukes and to launch World War III. I'm just trying to get it straight. So it's okay if we send tons of money. It's okay if we send equipment and weapons, but there's just something we can't do, because if we did, that would cause Vladimir Putin to fire nukes. See, I'm not clear on that. So if anyone can help me with that, I'd appreciate it. So that's going on. And meanwhile, there's this thing happening with the economy. Now, if we listen to the economists, the economy is still doing okay. You know, it's strong. Now, if you're in the stock market, maybe you've lost a few bucks of late. But again, did you see where the Dow is? And compare it to, say, where we were a few years ago. I mean, it's still at a ridiculous level. Now, I'm not invested because I don't have any money. But, you know, people are freaking out because everything is costing more. And that is completely understandable. The question is, you know, how did we get here? Well, we have a guest coming up in just a moment. As soon as he returns to the Zoom room, I will bring him in. Let me tell you a little bit about Jonathan Larson, who's our guest today. You know him. He's been on the show before, but you know him from before that even. He worked, Jonathan was at MSNBC back, I believe, in the Keith Olbermann days. And then he worked with Chris Hayes, and he worked with Rachel Maddow. And even before that, he worked at Air America with Rachel Maddow. And so this he's been doing this work for a long time. These days, Jonathan Larson is the managing editor of the Young Turks, and he joins us here on the show. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, I'm sorry. You got me a little earlier than I was expecting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, shit. Oh, I am. And I know you mentioned that you've got a bit of a cold. Not COVID, I hope.
I was trying to do all the nose blowing and other other fun, totally appealing stuff before you guys came to me. Sorry about that.
I understand. No worries. I was trying to get the shot set up because, you know, I do everything myself here. So while I'm talking and fumfering and stalling, I'm trying to get I usually do it ahead of time. And today, I don't know. I think it's I understand Mercury's in retrograde again, so maybe that's affecting me. But I think more than that is this descent into, you know, Gilead 2.0, because we're in this, I was going to say brave new world, but we're in this dystopian world that I never thought we'd arrive at. You know, Roe v. Wade was decided by the Supreme Court back in 73. I was 13. Well, hello, now I'm 62. I never thought we'd see this in my lifetime. I never thought my daughter would have to worry, were she to become pregnant with an unwanted pregnancy or something of that, that she'd have to worry about this. And here we are.
Yep.
It's hard to take it all in. And then, as I was saying, you try to put it sort of in a ranking order of all the shit going on in our world. And it's pretty scary what the stuff we're going through.
Well, for me, what's scary is I'm sort of an eternal optimist in the sense that I see the course of American history as one of pendulums, right? Mm-hmm. We make progress and then we backslide. There's a reaction to it. We make progress and then we backslide. And so for me, the question is, where's the floor at the moment? How far do we fall back before people start to figure out, oh, we had all these things for a reason, right? Like Roe v. Wade was decided in a context where people, there was growing awareness of the realities of abortion and reproductive rights and what people, women were facing in the absence of safe and legal abortion.
Right. But, and so that we have this all of a sudden return to this, and I can't call it Christian fundamentalism because that's, it's not
can.
Even that. Can I? It's well, more it's, like Christian Sharia law. The same people who bitch about, you know, the rules of a Islamic nation imposing these restrictive rules on the women mostly, the Sharia law. Well, that's exactly what they're doing, isn't it? Just calling it something different.
There are certainly legislative differences, I guess, if you want to say, in terms of what the rules are. But the most honest of them are pretty straightforward about what the source is, right? What manuscript they're following? What's the premise for the litigation legislation that they want to put forward? It's their interpretation of the Bible,
right? But I thought the First Amendment guarantees me the right to not have to deal with any prescribed religion and to not follow any religion at all if I don't want to, and I don't want to.
Well, they've been very smart, I think, about changing the terms. Ironically, they've done this with evolution as well. Their arguments evolve, right? They mutate, and right. The ones that don't work fall by the wayside.
Survival of the fittest. Right.
Those become survival of the fittest. And so... So in terms of freedom of religion, what they would say is freedom of religion is my freedom to practice my religion in any context, no matter what impact it has on other people. So if I get a job in the medical profession where I am licensed, I have to pass state certifications. These are all things the state is granting me. But there's no recognition that you now have obligations not to bring your illegal, religious, non-factual, unempirically based prejudices to the job, and you're not allowed to ask or guess whether your patient or the married couple or the would-be parents are LGBTQ or transgender or whatever. Shut up. You know, you're operating within the context of a society that has said you can practice, but you can't do the job in our society in a way that has our society and our government's imprimatur and licensing and all those things. No, you don't get to transform those jobs in a way that suits you just because you claim that there's a magic dude who wrote a book that says you can't. Not good.
Right, right. But they do it anyway. You know, and now I guess we've got five Catholics on the Supreme Court who say this is the way we, you know, this is our religion, and you need to follow. I don't know. It just doesn't make sense.
Well,
to
but
me.
The problem with Democrats is they help them, mm-hmm. not in terms of the specifics that the Christian right are pursuing, but in terms of legitimizing the foundation,
yes.
right, the legal and logical foundation that the right, the Christian right has for these things. Freedom of religion? Yeah, sure, we're on board, of course. You know, and so they fund and they endorse all of these things, as you and I have talked about before, the family, which runs the National Prayer Breakfast,
mm-hmm.
has lots of Democratic support,
yeah.
and they use it to build anti-LGBTQ, anti-abortion networks, right-wing networks,
that's right.
not just in the U.S., but around the world.
That's right. But you know what, Jonathan? I wrote down the first thing you said in that last statement, the problem with Democrats. And that's what I think it all boils down to. What the hell? This, I think they have been
asleep
at the wheel.
In fairness, there are some. I shouldn't lump them all together. I, you know, as a reporter, I've focused on the ones who are uh-huh. sort of collaborating.
Uh-huh.
But there are ones that are trying.
Thank God. Right?
Yeah.
Because
ironically,
right.
Yeah.
yeah. Thank the imaginary man in the
thank
sky.
Jesus specifically.
Right. No, that doesn't work for me, but okay, you can go there. So, Jonathan Larson, believe it or not, this isn't even what we're here to talk about today, but it just happened, and I watched that vote. And boy, Kamala Harris, Oh, shoot. I have got it up on this computer, so I don't think you would hear it if I played it. I just have the very end, and she sounded so, so defeated when she said, here, she said, I see it on the screen.
Born not having voted in the affirmative, the motion is not agreed to.
The motion is not agreed to. Yeah, it was not agreed to because they filibustered it without without having to actually filibuster anything, because we don't have a talking filibuster. They filibustered it, so it never even came to a vote. This was Chuck Schumer's strategy to take a vote that they knew they would lose, to get everybody on record as to where they stand. Is there anybody we didn't know where they stood before today?
Well, I always assume that this is essentially part of the marketing campaign that's going to get rolled out in the general election, right? Anyone who cast a vote, that can be used against them in the general election. I always assume that's the plan. But to your point, they do have the talking filibuster. They can very easily decide we're not going to just fold on knowing the procedural outcome. Yeah. We're going to go through the procedure. And if Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio wants to spend 18 hours with occasional dip-ins by the cable networks talking about how women should be forced to bring their pregnancies, dangerous or unwanted mm-hmm. or otherwise, to term, then that's what the rules say you can do or have to do if you actually want to filibuster this.
Right. And why the Democrats have given that up, I don't know. The problem with Democrats is what you said. And I'm going to keep going back to that. So the reason that I invited you on the program today, though, Jonathan Larson, is because of an article you wrote. It's posted at TYT.com. You are the managing editor of the Young Turks. And it's there today. And the headline reads, "How Trump Caused Inflation." Yeah. And then it says, "Trump blocked regulations against price manipulation. Biden has yet to acknowledge the problem." Again, it's that problem. They keep doing, it's there. We can't ignore it. And I think we need to call it, look, I'm no David Gergen acolyte, but he made a point today that I've been screaming about. He said, everybody who's in their 80s needs to go home and make way for new leadership, for new talent, for new people. Oh my God, please. The Democrats are killing us. Leadership in the Democratic Party is killing us because they don't know when it's time to go home, I think.
Well, I actually disagree with you on that.
Really?
Point, but it's a tangent we don't need to get into.
No, we don't. But let's talk about how Trump caused inflation. So inflation, sure. One thing that I'm constantly trying to interject, because it seems like nobody in the corporate media is doing it, is inflation is not a problem unique to the United States today. It is a global issue. It was also, exacerbated by the pandemic and the supply mm-hmm. chain problems and everything. It's not just us. And therefore, it's not Joe Biden. He didn't cause this. But you're saying Trump did.
So especially when you're talking about Wall Street, and especially in an economic ecosphere that is entirely globally connected, right? Right now we have Russia selling fertilizer to Brazil, which then grows soybeans, which then get exported back to China. So it's very hard to unentangle and say, well, inflation in this country is caused by, now there may be countries where you have crazy 1,000% inflation that's obviously caused by their economic policy. But in this case, the sort of thesis of the piece, based on the people I spoke to, was that Wall Street trading has essentially amplified what were otherwise natural problems in the pricing, right?
Okay.
The war in Ukraine, supply chain issues. The problem that we have is that essentially imagine a marketplace, right? Where you've got one guy trying to sell a barrel of oil and 10 guys, pardon the sexism, but we're talking about Wall Street. So.
Yes.
and you've got 10 guys who don't have any oil, but they have these contracts that in theory have to do with oil, right? So all of these people come to the market. What that one guy wants to sell his barrel of oil for doesn't really matter in terms of influencing what the overall pricing environment is. It's those other 10. And that's what we have right now in both commodities markets, where I sell you a barrel of oil, and in futures markets, where you and I essentially agree that in 6 months from now, you'll buy a barrel of oil from me for $70 or whatever. And then there are the derivative markets, which are one-to-one exchanges. Okay. These are not on broader markets. These are just you and me as individuals who work for Goldman Sachs or whatever. You and I are betting on what those other two markets are going to do.
Right.
And the problem is that all of this Wall Street churn ends up overwhelming what even the oil companies might want to sell their barrels of oil for. And I'll give you an example, right? In a properly functioning commodities market, economy, two things should happen. One is the futures market exists to smooth out momentary spikes, right? That's why you and I agree on selling a barrel 6 months from now for a certain amount. That means you don't have to freak out because you already know you've got your oil coming. But the other thing is, in a free market, if those 10 people in the marketplace want to sell their barrel of oil for $10 for $80 each, in theory, and lots of companies do this all the time in other markets, they would say, you know what, this is a great opportunity for me to capture market share by undercutting them. That's how Amazon became Amazon.
Right, of course. Right? They were loss leaders. Yes, loss leaders, right.
So
undercutting
why
everybody.
Is no one doing that? And the reason no one's doing that is because the market is so dominated by these Wall Street trades that have nothing to do with the actual people selling. And the reason I blame it on Trump in the headline is because this came about despite Dodd-Frank, because in Dodd-Frank, they attempted the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the agency that has regulatory oversight, they came up with rules that essentially said, you know what, we're not going to let you Wall Street firms play footsie. If you have an affiliate in London that's doing these swaps, we get to cover them too. Anything, any other company that you're guaranteeing, in other words, if you're standing behind with your money, if you're standing behind that London affiliate's bets, we get to regulate that too. And so the loophole that Wall Street came up with was, let's just stop guaranteeing our affiliates' bets. So now, all of a sudden, they could create and utilize thousands of legal entities, even that might be paper fictions, you know, shell companies that technically existed in a file somewhere in London, but it was a trader in Greenwich going to work in Lower Manhattan, doing his swaps trade there, and then checking a box on a form that said, I am in London. And because he checked that box, the CFTC now has no regulation.
Wow.
Hundreds of trillions of dollars of swaps trades flooded into these quote unquote overseas markets.
Oh, wow.
Now, the Obama administration, the CFTC under Obama, which was obviously dominated by Democrats, they found this out. They discovered this and they moved probably too slowly. They came up with a rule that was going to close all of this, shut it all down. They proposed the rule in October of 2016.
Oh, my God.
Now, you may remember what happened the following month.
Yeah.
So Trump not only said, I'm going to dismantle Dodd-Frank, I'm going to kill two regulations for every one that I
forgot about that. Yes, right.
He put in place people who took those edicts seriously, a guy who ran the CFTC and Steven Mnuchin at Treasury. And Mnuchin said specifically in a report before he was in office the first year, get rid of this rule that would close those loopholes, get rid of it. And before Trump was out of office, they did. They succeeded in getting rid of even that proposed rule. So because that rule was never enacted due to Trump, this Wall Street stuff was allowed to go unfettered. And unfortunately, and here's the problem with Democrats, if you want to
predict another one, got a check mark.
The Democrats have been too slow and to recognize the problem and to take action. And even frankly, between Biden and the Senate, they were too slow. And this is progressive groups telling me this, they were too slow to populate the commission at the CFTC and give it its full roster of five commissioners, which only happened at the end of March more than a year after Biden took office. So the good news is there's a lot they can do, but I'm sorry.
That's fine. No, and you can keep talking. But the thing that comes through, you know, ran through my mind is, you know, it's one thing to make mistakes. We all do. But, you know, when I was a boss, this was always my thing. Make a mistake. The first time you make a mistake, I'm right there with you. If you do not learn from that mistake and you repeat it, that's when I have a problem. When you talk about them being slow to do any of this stuff, hello, where's Merrick Garland? I mean, it seems like a lot of the problems with Democrats today have to do with the speed of molasses at which they operate. It's like, where is the sense of urgency? Where's the fierce urgency of now?
So one thing I heard, and this is not meant as a defense, right? Because part of the job is to have the relevant expertise. But one thing I heard was that at each agency, they came into office and they looked around and all of them saw 15 different fires that they knew how to put out. And the thing with the swaps trading that I'm talking about is it's a frog in the apocryphal pot of boiling water.
Right.
And so no one needs to take care of that frog right this second at any given time. So it goes on the back burner, no pun intended.
Right. Right. And here we are. And then we still have 20 things in each department. Now it's not 15, but it's 20 things in each department that needs to be put out, fires, and yet they're all smoldering. So here we
are. Things, if you want, I can walk you through some of the steps that the government actually can take.
Okay. Please.
So one is, obviously, the CFTC could decide we're going to bring that rule back and we're going to close that loophole. The problem with that is that's going to take a very long time. The other thing they could do is we're going to launch investigations. They are empowered by law to look into potential price manipulation, excessive speculation, as well as potential antitrust violations by the fact that all of these companies are doing the same thing. And the market is absolutely dominated by four or five banks.
Right.
Four banks,
You know, I can't play devil's advocate in each one of these. I can say, well, they could launch investigations, but if they lose control of the House in November, those committees all go away. The Republicans are not going to continue any work the Democrats do. And even if it's, you know, work for the common good, as we learned from, you know, Trump going after one of his one of the candidates who lost last night. Because the guy actually voted for the infrastructure bill.
Mooney and McKinley.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
he voted for the infrastructure bill. That's a reason to oppose.
I'm going to bring you billions of dollars for roads and internet and water service.
Right.
You're out, buddy.
Right. So it's you're not on my team. And then antitrust. Hello. We've got these antitrust laws that are toothless because nobody enforces them. So, you know, yeah, we have solutions that we don't take advantage of. We have oversight, but we have no enforcement.
So one former CFTC guy actually told me that you don't even need the investigations to have teeth. Literally, all you need is from the CFTC or any of the 50 states' attorneys general, they could do this too. If any of them say, we're launching an investigation into this, Just the prospect of that will likely have a dampening effect on all of this activity. They'll cool it off probably overnight. So they don't even have to do much more than issue a press release. The problem with Democrats, to sing your favorite song that I heard from multiple sources, is that both at the White House and on Capitol Hill, there are very, very few Democrats who understand the way these Wall Street commodity derivative markets are functioning at the moment.
Can we clone Katie Porter? Because I think she gets it.
The thing is, she probably would get it if it were explained to her. But the most of the alarms that were put up about what was going on with all this trading was that it could lead to another 2008. Right. If you have all of these trades out there that are being unregulated, those are dominoes. And all it takes is one domino for us to need another big bailout to save the world economy, which is, of course, comes out of our pockets. No one's really looked at, which is ironic because this is what happened last time gas went up to $4 a gallon.
That's right.
That was due to Wall Street speculation via a loophole called the Enron loophole, which I know because I reported on it at the time.
Right.
And they closed it and prices came down. So not too big a surprise that now we have this again. But Democrats, in theory, there should be the institutional knowledge to recognize, oh, this is how it happened last time. This is what we did last time to fix it. We can do that now.
Okay. But again, going back to the whole thing that it's not just a problem here in the U.S. It's a global issue. Inflation. Sure. And we're not just talking about the price of oil. We're talking about the price of everything.
Minerals. Yep.
Everything. And if things keep going as they are in Ukraine, they're the world's top supplier of grain. So we're looking at massive global food shortages because they can't, I'm sure they're not harvesting anything and probably can't, you know, they're not getting it out of the ground and they're not getting it out of the country. So this is going to show up in terms of price increases for food and shortages of food over the next year, isn't it?
I'm not expert on that right. end of things, but the issue with Wall Street is, of course, you're going to have pricing issues when you have shortages. Look at the stuff with infant formula that we're having.
Oh my
now,
God! Right? Yeah.
The problem is that excuse me, Wall Street's the markets, the futures markets. They're supposed to cushion, right? They're supposed to be shock absorbers for these price spikes
right.
and drops. They're doing the opposite. They're amplifying these things. So one oil analyst who was quoted in The Guardian said something like, if developments in Ukraine would normally be expected to increase the price of the barrel by 50 cents or a dollar, now you're seeing that as much as $10 because yeah. it's amplified because all those traders... All those Wall Street traders, they look at that and they say, oh, that's a reason to run it up. And so they keep ratcheting it up based on that one little
right. And how much and how much profiteering is going on? How much are the big companies, oil companies and others in other industries, jacking up the prices now because they can?
Well, the irony is that, like I said before, to varying degrees in varying commodities, the companies don't have the say they used to, uh-huh. right? If they wanted, for instance, to grab up that market share, remember, Wall Street's doing right. 10 times the amount of trading gotcha. They are.
Yeah.
They are. So if they came in and tried to undercut, their supply would vanish, you know, in the heartbeat of a day trader and not have an impact. It would disappear like a okay. pebble in the ocean, you know, no ripple. Meanwhile, the other 10 Wall Street traders for each oil company trader, they're raising the sea levels.
Right. Okay.
So yes, the gas companies are certainly happy about this because they're the ones actually selling that commodity
right.
at that price.
Right. And reaping the profits, but they're not right. in control of it. But so I got to ask you, because I still
go
back
mean
to
that they're not like happy to lean.
Of course.
In that direction.
They're doing the happy yeah. dance. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
So, but remember, Jonathan, during the pandemic when nobody was driving and the price of a gallon of gas was like below $2, mm-hmm. again, it's supply and demand, people. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Trump, you know, miraculously lowering the price of gas so you could pay less at the pump. The cost, it was a negative. There was like a week or two in there when the price of a barrel of oil was like negative $12. They couldn't give it away, right?
Right, right. It was more expensive to store it than
yes.
to own it or something like that. Yeah.
And now here we are. It's like, wait a minute. Shouldn't there be some kind of happy medium? What about the futures? Couldn't they somehow buy it at that price? You know, I'm not an economist and I think about this shit and my eyes roll back in my head because yeah. I know how to spend yeah. money, but that's about it. But that stuff like that makes me crazy.
Well, we actually did a story right at the beginning of the pandemic. Investigative reporter Tiwa Cheng worked for us at the time, and he obtained audio of a conference call between, I think it was Morgan Stanley and their lobbyists. And they were talking about their oil company clients, and they were saying, we need to push the government to get people back to work. Why? So that they would have to buy gas
yes.
for the commute.
Oh, my God.
And lift the price.
Yeah. And here we are. Hello.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, and people are still getting COVID. You don't have COVID, right? You're just sick?
I don't have a fever, so apparently I just have a standard cold, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
right.
I've been very lucky. My family's been very lucky.
Us too. Well, I don't leave the house, so, you know, that helps.
But... we're lucky not to have to leave the house.
Right. Right?
That's part of the luck.
Hello. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Work from home. It's a brave new world. All right. So so here we are. We are screwed in so many ways and none of them good. Inflation, it's here. Now, today we had some relatively good news. The consumer price index came down ever so slightly. And you heard the few optimists out there saying, well, maybe we've reached peak inflation.
You know, right.
Do you know where we are? What's going to happen now?
I mean, no one does, right, really. But the bigger picture is that's part of the problem, right? If it's all a mystery, if we can't make our judgments, our predictions anymore based on the fundamentals of supply and demand, and things like, you know, supply chain efficiency, if those fundamentals don't let us predict things anymore, that's a sign that something else is influencing our pricing and potentially even our supplies, right? In theory, someone could monkey with the supplies to make their Wall Street bets pay off, right? Who knows?
Right.
So the fact that we can't make a relatively sound prediction or confident prediction, that's a warning sign that something is amiss in our system, which means they found a way through Dodd-Frank, which means we've got to plug that hole.
And again, so right now we have the Democrats ostensibly in charge for, you know, as much as good that's doing, but they are holding off, you know, the crazies on the right from doing more damage, I suppose. What happens if they get back in office? Does Trump then roll back any changes that Biden may have made to try to fix the damage that he did? Are we just on this endless roller coaster?
Well, to some extent, yeah, I think we're on an endless roller coaster, what I referred to before as a pendulum. And part of the problem is, sorry to be this guy, but I'm not one of those blame the voters people.
Right.
But in this case, if voters don't make the effort and political leaders don't educate them, they won't understand how stuff works. So, of course, they're going to do the easy, feels good, intuitive, BS, no pain choice, even if that's the one that hurts them and their kids in perpetuity, right? So, yeah, of course, everyone should be free to make. Who's the government to say that I can't make a trade, a swaps trade with a trader in Singapore?
Right.
What business is it of the government's? It's complicated to explain what the business is, right?
Right.
And if voters don't have the stomach anymore for it's complicated, then yeah, the pendulum's going to keep swinging the bad way.
So then let me ask you a question that's totally, you know, devil's advocate. Is this move by the Supreme Court to take us back, as I wrote the other day, one step up and 50 years back, maybe a blessing in disguise for the Democrats?
I mean, look.
Because that's easier to understand than these swaps and future commodities and shit like that. They're gonna take away my right to choose what I do with my body?
I mean, in theory, politically, you would think that would be a gift, right? You would think that would be a political gift. The problem might be that our electorate has become so severed from caring about other people, or caring about facts, or caring about outcomes and how you get good outcomes, that maybe they won't even listen to what Democrats have to say, or what women have to say, or what the media has to say about women's horror stories. So the big hurdle I see is a lot of, like, the resistance is sort of seems premised on the idea that the only way to fight back is to reject in toto the humanity and the reachability of the other people. And it seems to me that that's a sure way of inculcating in them, right, instilling in them the desire not to listen to Democrats. And yes, there are some awful people pushing this stuff who believe awful things. But to my mind, and based on my experience as a journalist, the vast majority of Americans do not have hard and fast positions on Griswold v. Connecticut or Dodd-Frank.
Right. But they do on a woman's right to choose.
They do. They do. But that can be moved by horror stories about late-term abortions, or it can be moved about horror stories about forced abortions.
Yeah, but you know what? This is a perfect lead-in to what they do. The lying, and I get it. They lie about everything. It's endemic to them, I guess. They can't help themselves. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt here. The lie that they're all pushing now, and I heard it from Ted Cruz. I heard it from some woman who had some agency on a Fox interview. I heard it from, who was the other one? Another, somebody who knows better. That what those Democrats want is the ability to abort. Oh, my idiot governor, moron death sentence, or just to Satan, as I now call him. That women, those Democrats want the right to abort a baby, a child, as they say, not only up to the point of birth, but after, right, or back up a day or two and do infanticide. It's like, where did they get this crap? Nobody, literally, not one person is calling for abortions up to the, up to birth or after. But that is a talking point for them. They have there is no shame, but they have no problem with lying about that. And do their Lemmings followers just believe them?
Well, that's the theory I was trying to get at before, is that a lot of people don't know a lot of these things. And so they don't necessarily have to consciously lie themselves. They just trust the authoritative, good-looking dude in a suit and tie, right, who feels like, oh, they know what they're doing.
He went to Harvard. He went to Yale. He's got to know what he's talking about.
Right. But there was, I think it was Michigan, right? There was a debate. I think it was the attorney general's debate. And the moderator asked a question about Griswold v. Connecticut.
And
these were all people running to be the top state law official in their state. And not a single one of the Republican candidates
knew
what this landmark Supreme Court case even was, let alone the core issue at the heart of it. So it's always a mistake, I think, to underestimate the stupidity.
There you go.
That may be at work here. But more to the point is, I don't think you get anywhere assuming evil. I just don't think that gets you anything.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I get it's a trade-off. It's partly it's tactical, right? Maybe it gets you more support on your side, right? Maybe it gins up excitement and enthusiasm on your side. And maybe that does make you win. I don't know. But I'm also concerned about the body politic, right? The civics and the political ethics of all the people. Like, we should be trying to win those people over, even if it doesn't win us elections.
Yeah.
Right?
But it's hard to do. I mean, mm-hmm. when somebody, I guess you saw it, Florida, we're just riddled with just despicable people. And so we have the guy who is the former governor, who is now a senator from Florida,
Rick Scott.
Yeah. And apparently he made a statement about Joe Biden the other day. And here's he was asked about it at the presser he did the other day on inflation, of all things.
You called out Rick Scott a little while ago in your remarks. Earlier today, anticipating your remarks, he said, and I'm just quoting here, that the best thing, most effective thing Joe Biden can do to solve the inflation crisis he created is resign. He's the problem. The senator added later, Joe Biden is unwell, he's unfit for office, he's incoherent, incapacitated, and confused. These are his words, offering him a chance to respond.
I think the man has a problem.
I think the man has a problem. He just let it go. But that there's no civility there anymore. There's no even pretense of it. How do you play nice with people who, treat you like that?
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen write-ups or the actual tweets of this, but I love this. This happened several years ago. Sarah Silverman, mm-hmm. The comedian.
Oh, sure.
She was attacked by a MAGA guy on Twitter, and what she did, and I feel like I've had a similar experience, is you just don't address the personal attacks, and you assume good faith on the part of the other person. not necessarily that they are good people or whatever. You don't address that, because who the hell are we to address whether someone's a good person?
Right.
You try to get at what is their underlying concern. And then you grapple honestly with whatever that is. And Sarah Silverman did that with this guy who's now pretty big on Twitter. I think his name is David Wasserman.
Okay.
He's got a pretty big Twitter account. And this whole dialogue played out in Twitter, right? Everyone could watch it step by step. And she basically reeled him in by just, don't respond to the vitriol. Don't respond to the ad hominem. Assume that the person has a good faith concern and try to recognize what it is and get to the heart of the matter. I wish I could remember what the specific issue was this guy was talking about, but you know, on abortion, for instance,
right?
If it's for the well-being of children, there are lots of obvious ways to go there, right?
Right. Yes, there are.
You're probably more better versed than I am.
Look, I'm an adoptive mother. I adopted a child. Thank God that the woman who gave birth to my little girl in Kazakhstan didn't abort her, you know, but I believe she had the right to do so. I'm glad she gave birth to her and I have an amazing kid. Yeah. Nothing is so black and white, but the way we're put in boxes, it seems to be. Sarah Silverman has always been very good at that. She had that short-lived TV show on one of the streaming networks where she would go into the homes of these, Trumpers and try to find common ground with them. She's a better woman than I am, because I don't think I could do that.
Well, you're a lot closer, I think, to the front lines in some ways. Yep. Obviously, she was literally out there, but you're there every day fighting these fights. And it's hard not to, when you engage in good faith with these people, it can feel like you're betraying the people you're supposed to be defending against them.
Right.
Right. You know, if a Nazi comes up to you, you're supposed to destroy them, right? But what if you can deprogram them? Which, by the way, is actually what happened.
Right. But you know what? There's so much gray area here. And I'm keeping you so much longer. I hope you don't mind, because I'm enjoying this conversation. But the whole situation in Ukraine, we have on the left a very robust anti-war effort, movement, group, right? Who have all, to my mind, jumped the shark. These people, David Swanson used to be friendly with me. He's all seemingly in for Russia, and Ukraine is doing the wrong thing because they won't negotiate and they won't give in and surrender. Right. It's like, what? Somebody who's a friend of mine who was born in Ukraine, in Soviet Ukraine, is married to one of these anti-war people. And she was going to come back on the show with me this week, and she can't, because she's like warring with him over the situation over there. What seems to me to be pretty black and white, all of a sudden these real, left-wing anti-war people all seem to be siding with Putin. A lot of things don't make sense.
Well, I had this conversation with a friend the other day who was actually working on a commencement speech for college. And we talked about how so much of our politics have been upended. And it's very difficult right now to necessarily predict.
Yeah.
Will the right be uniform on this? Will the left be uniform on that? How should we even be defining the left and the right at this point, right? So, it's a little messy. And I think we've also gotten bad about, we conflate, like we are certain about outcomes, right? We're too confident about outcomes, which means that we now connect the tactics that we think will yield those outcomes. We're now confident in those tactics, right? This now becomes the right thing to do. So you and your Ukrainian-born friend, you might both agree that the best outcome is for as few people as possible to die.
Hello. Yes.
Right? That might. But he or she might think, well, that might mean some concessions of autonomy. And you might think, well, that's not worth it. And so you might both have positive outcomes, but if you good faith outcomes that you want to see, but if you're equally certain about that your favorite tactic versus his, or hers will have the right outcome, then all of a sudden now you're fighting
right
over something we can't know. And I think that actually is at the heart of a lot of the internecine fighting on the left, is that people treat it as obvious that this tactic will obviously work. Therefore, anyone who is against that tactic is against that outcome, which means they're really working for the other side.
Yes. And that's when heads explode. And that's where I find myself so often. It's frustrating because you think you've got common sense and you expect that the other halfway brilliant people around you do as well. But somehow their line of thinking goes in the other direction. It's like, that's a disconnect. I don't understand how can you be one of us, be so anti-war and be, you know, siding with Putin against Zelensky. That's right. It's like,
right. And therefore you now are for war.
Right.
You're a backer of the military industrial. Right. I can't even remember Eisenhower's phrase. Thank
Complex.
You. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. If you say, well, of course we should help someone defend themselves and not be killed. Now you're all of a sudden pro-gun, you're pro-military,
right.
You're pro-militarization,
right.
You're in favor of the American empire.
Right.
Well, no,
when I said to one of these people that, you know, Putin it seems to be going through some things and maybe we just need to take him out. Oh, you're for murder. You want to murder a world leader. It's like, oh my God. Okay. I'm going to end this conversation here because we're really not getting anywhere. But that's where we are. And it's not, you know, on all fronts. So, you know, our anxiety level is up here.
Right.
And we're freaking out because we can't pay the bills and everything's more expensive and COVID is still rampant. And we've got an election on the way and a party who's neutered. And January 6th hasn't been prosecuted. And oh, my right. God, it makes you just want to crawl back in bed and put the covers over your head.
I should say I am also against political assassination, but to me, it's like there are a lot of middle steps there that the U.S. has not proven willing to take. They're not part of the International Criminal Court I think it is,
which we have not signed on to. Hello,
right.
Let's take
right.
them to The Hague, but we need to be a part. See, maybe we won't
right.
do that because George Bush might be brought
right.
up on charges.
Yeah, right. Or the Cheney Bot 3000.
Hello,
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I love the first thing that those same people said when we got into this. We've been doing this. This is all our fault. That's the thing I left out. It's not only Putin, but it's America. Where are the architects? It all comes back to us because we are the evil empire.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't find evil to be a constructive
no, nor do I.
But for viewing actions, and I'm not suggesting you do.
Right,
I realize you're being accused of
right,
that.
Exactly.
But there definitely is an argument for how American foreign policy has given Putin rationales across the years, right?
Sure.
I believe it was George W. Bush who gave Putin assurances about U.S. or NATO. I don't remember the specifics, but basically, nope, we didn't hold true to that. So, of course, he's going to feel threatened, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
So if he thinks, if his military commanders have told him, Of course, our army is functional. Then why wouldn't he say, you know what, then I'm going to have them be a little further out.
Right.
Right. I'm not saying he should.
Right.
I'm not saying that's the right thing to do. I am not on your friend's side.
Right. But you can see how they arrive at that conclusion.
Right. And the inability to see how, and that's what I was getting at before, is if you can only ascribe your opponent's motives to them being evil, that makes them very hard to predict and understand, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And if we had seen all along, oh, we've broken promises to Putin,
yeah.
So how might he see that, right? And the Soviet Union, right? This is history 101 stuff in the textbooks, right? In with the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had missiles in Turkey.
Yes. Right.
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 We had basically, you know, Russia wanted to put up a tent in Cuba, and we had like strings of condos in Turkey.
Right. Yeah. This has been going on and will continue going on. I got perfect comment from the chat room to wrap up on. Terry says, such a reasonable, thoughtful man Jonathan is. And you are. Jonathan Larson, I've enjoyed this conversation. We were only going to talk for like 15, 20 minutes or so. But, I've enjoyed this. And you helped me immensely because I've been having a rough time the last few days slogging through all the crap that is thrown at us. So
we're also not obliged to immerse ourselves in all of it. We're
that's
just
true.
Not.
I know.
We're
and I
not.
Know I have an hour a day and I know I can't cover everything.
Right.
But right. But it still gets to me. Even if I don't talk about it, it still gets to me. What can I tell you?
Well, thank you, Nicole. And thank you, Terry.
Thank you so much, Jonathan Larson. Find him on the Twitters at JT Larson and, of course, at the Young Turks. And I'm seeing the Young Turks programming more and more since I cut the cable cord. And now we have YouTube television and you guys have a channel. So you're in my house.
So we're a monster on the YouTubes.
Yes, you are. I'm very impressed. All right. Jonathan, great talking to you. Thank you for writing this. This is an excellent article. I tweeted it and I put it on the in both chat rooms, and I will link to it from the blog today where I post the show. Everyone should read it. It's long, but it's full of information, and it's really good. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
All right. You take care and feel better.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, everyone. That's it for us for today. I'm going to leave you with the news because I can, and I'll see you tomorrow. Howie Klein will be here, and from Wisconsin, Tom Nelson, who's running for the Senate, who should and could win. I know he's not the preferred, Democratic Party candidate. He's the progressive. And so just another option for you. Okay, leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody. And bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
If it's Wednesday, the Senate is voting on the Women's Health Protection Act, which would codify Roe v. Wade into law. Unfortunately, Democrats need 60 votes to break a Republican filibuster, which they don't have. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer saying that this vote was about mobilizing voters, not passing legislation in a Congress where Democrats hold majorities but don't have the votes to defeat Republican filibusters or change the Senate rules to eliminate them. Not very Democratic. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse reiterated the need for a new FBI investigation into Brett Kavanaugh and his rushed confirmation to the Supreme Court. Tuesday was also primary day in Nebraska and West Virginia, and it was a mixed outcome for the former guy. In the Nebraska gubernatorial primary, Trump had endorsed businessman Charles Herbster, a man who's been credibly accused of groping and forcibly touching 8 women. Well, he lost. Actually, he placed second, missing out only by a few points, to hog producer and University of Nebraska regent Jim Pillen, who had been endorsed by the current governor, Pete Ricketts. In West Virginia, 2 incumbent members of Congress were competing to represent 1 seat as West Virginia lost a seat in the current round of redistricting. So in this case, the guy that Trump endorsed, Alex Mooney, beat the other guy, Congressman David McKinley. McKinley is a Trump supporter, but Trump criticized him because he dared to vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill and for the creation of the January 6th committee. I guess no good deed goes unpunished. Next Tuesday is a big one, with primaries being held in Idaho, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Oregon. Well, as expected, the Bureau of Labor Statistics this morning released new data that shows that inflation may have peaked, even though we're still feeling maximum pain. In April, the Consumer Price Index rose 8.3% compared with a year ago and 0.3% compared to the month before. That's the slowest increase since last summer. And that's a good indicator. So it's encouraging news, but we've still got a long slog ahead. President Biden on Tuesday defended his efforts to fight inflation, telling the country that reining in rising prices is his top domestic priority. The White House has said that inflation was being fueled by pandemic-caused supply chain bottlenecks and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has disrupted oil markets and drove up costs. Biden also accused, quote, ultra-MAGA Republicans of exploiting frustration over inflation to push their, quote, extreme agenda. Sounds about right to me. Well, a tense situation is getting even more tense after reports that Palestinian-American reporter Shireen Abu Akleh died on Wednesday after being shot in the head while covering Israeli raids in the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. Palestinian authorities and Al Jazeera accused Israeli forces of shooting the 51-year-old longtime Al Jazeera correspondent. Al Jazeera saying that Israeli forces shot Abu Akleh, quote, in cold blood, even though she had been clearly wearing a press jacket that identifies her as a journalist. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said, no, that it must have been Palestinian militants firing indiscriminately who were responsible for her death. Well, the Palestinian Health Ministry said a second journalist, Ali Al-Samoudi, of the Jerusalem-based Al-Quds newspaper, was also wounded by gunfire. Protests are ramping up throughout the region as the Foreign Press Association, Reporters Without Borders, the International Federation of Journalists, and others are condemning the killing and demanding a full, immediate, and transparent investigation into her death. Stay tuned.
We're number one, damn it!
Yeah, we are. The firearm homicide rate in the United States has hit its highest level since 1994, jumping by 35% in 2020 compared to 2019. All this according to data published Tuesday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The rates among Black boys and men aged 10 to 44 and among American Indian or Alaska Native men aged 25 to 44 showed the largest increases. CDC researchers writing in the report that the COVID-19 pandemic might have exacerbated existing social and economic stressors that increase risk for homicide and suicide, particularly among certain racial and ethnic communities. 79% of homicides and 53% of suicides involve guns. The House of Representatives on Tuesday passed a roughly $40 billion bill to deliver aid to Ukraine as it continues to face Russia's assault. The measure now goes to the Senate before it heads to President Biden to be signed into law. According to the measure, billions of dollars will be used to send military equipment and weapons from U.S. stocks to Ukraine and to purchase weapons from contractors, among other allocations. Ukrainian President Zelensky thanked Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the friends of his country for approving the bill. This latest round of funding comes as Belarus, a Russian ally, said it will deploy special forces to the border of Ukraine because, quote, the United States and its allies continue to increase their military presence at the state borders. Lovely. Meanwhile, Russia's assault has now set its sights on the key city of Odessa. Ukraine on Tuesday said that a counteroffensive by its forces has taken back four villages that Russia had previously seized near the northeastern city of Kharkiv. But our director of national intelligence, Avril Haines, testified on Tuesday that U.S. intelligence assessments are finding that Russia appears to be preparing for a prolonged conflict that could become, quote, more unpredictable and escalatory due to a mismatch between what Vladimir Putin wants and what his military can deliver. And finally, still using an iPod? Well, hold on to it. It might be worth something one day. Apple, now saying since its technology is included on every iPhone, is discontinuing its last iPod model. They'll still sell them until the current inventory runs out. And then, well, I guess you got a collector's item on your hands. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.